So this is, I always have to wait a little bit as it analyzes my voice. This is lesson one. So we're finally actually into the book of Judges. And, you know, so most of you know, for me, it's always like there's so much to tell you. And I will tell you that Judges used to take, did I tell somebody? I think it was a 14-week course or 17-week course. Now it's 7. Same material. So that, you know what a challenge that is for me. So now I have to go through 2 chapters, and obviously we're not going to go through chapters 17 through 21 except to use it as a touchstone. So obviously I have a lot, but my new desire is to not finish my lesson so much as slow it down enough that you get the core, so that you're not, I'm just trying to rush through things. That's not my tendency, so slow me down. Ask questions if you need to. Just contemplate what we're talking about. So we'll go from there. But this lesson is called Reorienting Our Sight for the Journey. And what I'd like to do, my format's a little bit different than usual. Usually I will have a review from what we did last week and the verse. My whole rhythm has changed. For 9 years I had the same rhythm, and now all of a sudden I'm changing rhythm. So I'm even noticing it, like, how did I forget all of that? We will still be doing all of that. I just think it's going to look a little different. But I do want to ask for things from last week so that we kind of solidify what we talked about last week and continue on with that. So what is the Bible's primary purpose? Why are you laughing, Sherilyn?
I'm just laughing because you asked what you think is a simple question.
I do think it's a simple question. What's the Bible's primary purpose? What did we talk about last week?
It's God's story.
Yes.
In order for us to know him.
Yes, exactly. The Bible's primary reason for being is to tell you his story and to invite you into his story. So no matter what you have been told, and really I don't think anybody's ever been told this, although maybe you have, it's not a handbook for doing a good life. It's not that. And if we approach it that way, we will completely miss what God is trying to show us. We will miss his story. So it's almost as if you were sitting in your groups today and you're all supposed to be sharing your story, and you come at it as, so what am I going to get out of their story? Instead of listening to their story and entering in their story, you want to know what's in it for you. That's kind of how we've approached Scripture, right? What's in it for me? Just tell me what I need to do, and that's all I want the Bible for. When God is trying to share his story, he's sitting in your group sharing his story, and you're looking for something for you. Like, oh, she went to church? Oh, maybe I should go to church. So there's a big difference in that. So the Bible's primary purpose is to share God's story and invite you into that. To know who God is and what he does. So we've talked about this now for 2 weeks. What is it that God does? Yes.
Ten.
Yep, create. So it, really, 2 things, right?
He
creates.
He names.
That's how he creates, right?
Oh.
So create and there's a rhythm, right? Create and rest. Create and rest. Create and rest. In creating, how does he create? So name.
Names.
Name, number one, right? He names.
Tens.
Multiplies in order to flourish. That's kind of our word for judges. So he creates by naming, by tending, and by multiplying to flourishment. And he does that with intention, with attention, and with connection. So there's that vulnerability part in that creating. If that's what he does, and he created us to be his image, then that obviously is what we are to be doing. That is our purpose as well. That's what we do as imagers of God. We name, we tend, and we multiply for flourishment. At least that's what we're being restored to do. So that's kind of where we've been so far in the last 2 weeks. And then noticing where he is actually restoring us to be able to name and to tend and to multiply with flourishment. So it's important to know that, because if you don't know that, then you don't know the context of Judges, and you will misinterpret. And again, you'll come in, you'll come at it as if it is a how-to. How do I do this? How do I do this? Rather than noticing what God's doing in the story and then bringing it to your life, what's God doing in my story? Is God there creating and resting in my story? Is he leading me to that same place? And as usual, it's getting really hot in here. So let's look at some of the background of what's happening in Judges so we know kind of where this is coming from, and then we'll go into the actual text. They are on a journey to restoration. We know that the sons of Israel has been given a charge, and they've been given that charge since they've come out of Exodus, is you are going to be my model for what it looks like to image bear. You're going to be the model for the rest of the world, and you're going to invite them into that kind of a life, a place where we're image bearing, where we're completely and fully who we're meant to be, individually and corporately. So they know that their purpose is to establish a place where they can model image bearing and invite into cohort. Remember we talked about cohort? Everybody know what I'm talking about when I talk about that? So that they know that that's their purpose. He's told them over and over and over again, and he said, you are a holy people, chosen to be a holy people. And he reiterates that in 1 Peter for us, doesn't it? He says, you are a royal priesthood, a holy people, chosen. You are a royal priesthood. We've talked about that's the term given to creating by naming, tending, and multiplying and flourishing. That's what a priest does. He calls people to God, to that connection, so that you can be whole and create and rest as God does. If that's the purpose, then how are they supposed to do it? And he tells them in Deuteronomy a million times, he says the first thing you're going to need to do is make sure there are no other gods. So what you're going to need to do, and he tells them very concretely, you're going to need to utterly destroy in order to make space. There has to be space for you to model image bearing, so you're going to have to utterly destroy. And this is where we tend to go, why does God do that? Because, of course, they're going to have to utterly destroy people. And, of course, they are enemies of Israel. They're enemies of everybody, actually, even each other. And why they are enemies and why they need to be destroyed is because they are people, they are cultures who have refused image bearing as their purpose and instead encouraged idol bearing. So what has happened, and we see this, God gives us a little bit of hint here and there, things like when he tells Abraham, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to your generations. You can't go into the land I'm promising you right now because the iniquity of the Amorites is not finished yet. Everybody know that verse? So that's right in Abraham's promise. What he's saying there is the people that are in the land, I'm giving them time. I'm going to give them time to either accept being an image bearer or refuse it and continue to be idol bearers. But I'm going to give them time. How much time does he give them from the time he talks to Abraham about it? 400 years. Yeah. He gives them 400 years to either take up their purpose or refuse it. So when we think about the fact that Israel goes in and slaughters all of these people, they're not innocent people. They are people who have been given 400 years plus. So that's just one inkling we have of the people there have been given a chance and have been given enough revelation to know that their purpose is to be image bearers. And they've refused and rather decided that they would rather bear their own images, be idol bearers. So that's who Israel is called to utterly destroy and make space. because they can't make space within a place that is encouraging idol bearing. And one thing you need to know about idol bearing is it will always try to encourage others to do the same. It has to. It has to build up themselves in order to do that. So God says you have to do this because if you leave them, they will snare you and they will take you away from knowing what your purpose is and living towards your purpose. And that then they will take away your wholeness. And you will never want to connect to your Zoe. You will never want to be whole and connect to me as the source of your life. So this is for your good. But not only for your good, because they, Israel, is to be a blessing to the whole world. They're the ones who are to model what their true purpose is. So if Israel fails to wipe all of these people out, to make a space so that they can be whole and image-bearing, then they can't pass on the blessing of being image-bearers. So this is serious stuff. This isn't just about Israel. It's about the whole world. If you don't utterly destroy the people who are encouraging idol-bearing and refusing to be image-bearers and make at least a small space in the world and a very important place, because of where it lands in the midst of that world at that time. If you don't make a space here, the whole world doesn't get to see and be invited into cohort. So you see how important it is that they utterly destroy, that they don't say, oh, it's okay if you live here. And of course, that's what we're going to see in Judges, how important it was that they utterly destroy all of the culture that said, no, idol bearing is where it's at. Everyone should be independent. Everybody should make their own way. Everybody should go in their own directions. So that's kind of the background of what is happening for Israel. And of course, we always want to think about, and I won't always tell you, where does that place you? But since we already know that in 1 Peter, God says, you also are called to be a holy nation, a royal priesthood. You're also called to do this, to make a model. Unfortunately, in Western Christianity, we think that means individual. One thing we're going to see in Judges is the corporate need to be a model and our responsibility to the corporate body to be a model of creating, being an image bearer. So what we're going to need to do is reorient our vision. One of the keywords, and I'm just going to take, so I usually give you all the keywords for the whole book and kind of go from there. I think I'm going to take a keyword every once in a while and show you, like, this is what we're going to look at. So one of the huge keywords in Judges is sight. Eyes, sight, what I see, all of that. So that's a really key word. And anytime you see a keyword, that means you should be alerted to any time it comes up. It's really telling you something very important about who God is and what God is doing. In Judges, what we're going to see is the contrast between what God sees and what man sees without being connected to God. So we're going to see that contrast over and over and over again in Judges. God's sight, man's sight. And the fact of the matter is that all of it is seen by God. And hardly any of it is seen by man. So if I say that we're going to reorient our sight, I do want to take us back to even that word orient. The original word orient, even in the English language, does anyone know what that actually meant? It actually meant to face east toward Jerusalem. That was the original meaning, to face east toward Jerusalem. In other words, to face toward God's presence. That's what the English word meant. That's what the Latin word meant. To face toward God's presence. So when we reorient, it means to face toward God's presence. Unfortunately, as always, our language moves and grows and changes. And now when we say to orient yourself, it means to face in whatever direction you want to go. Isn't that interesting, right? We've already changed it from face toward God's presence to face wherever you want to go. There's Judges right there, right in one word. We start by facing God and we end by, well, I'm going to face wherever I want to go. And we talked about the true north and the magnetic north, and that magnetic north is where you're pulled toward, where you want to go. So what we want to do here in Judges is learn again how to face the original direction, how to face God's presence. So that's what we're looking at, that's what we're following, that's what we see. So what happens now in Judges 1 and 2 is we're going to start telling you the story. And really, Judges 1 and 2 is the background for what's happening in the culture during Judges. Now, depending on which historical lines you take, Judges, the whole book of Judges takes either 200 years or 400 years. Not sure. I've always looked at it at 400 years. So it's a long time that this is happening, but it's becoming their pattern, and we're seeing that they are living this way. And in other words, they're completely losing sight of the original direction of where they are to be going. So, Judges 1:1, and she had us look at, was that a little overwhelming for you to look at 17 through 21?
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And like just...
1 and 2 were great.
Just read through it.
Yeah, like...
Just read through it.
Just read through it, but even just to read through it, oh, this is where we're going. This is the piece I just want you to understand is all you need to know is that's what the culture looked like from 17 to 21. That's what the culture looked like. Do not think that that is so far away from what the culture looks like today. But Judges 1:1, and the end of that, Judges 21. What is it? 25. That's kind of where we'll start there. So in Hebrew narrative, the first conversation you get is going to give you a basis for the plot. And then for us to look at the very end of the book, we realize what direction the plot's going. So the very first conversation that Judges starts with is actually is 1 and 2, right? So now it came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." What we see at the beginning of Judges, now remember, we've just come out of Joshua. So Joshua's just died. Joshua and all of Israel have been battling. They've fought. They have places now to live. And now Judges begins. And the conversation is between the sons of Israel and God. So what do we have here? What does it look like is going on? There's God, the sons of Israel, and they're all talking together.
Cohort.
Yeah, cohort, right? They're working in cohort. They are doing exactly what God has called them to do, and that is to work in cohort, to listen. They're asking God for direction. They're listening, and they're all together doing it. Notice it says the sons of Israel, all of them, were inquiring of God what to do, and God was answering them. And not only that, but then they were going ahead and doing it, right? So we start with cohort. But if we go all the way to the end, chapter 21, what are we ending with? All the things that you read from 17 to 21, what has happened to cohort? Gone, right? It's completely gone. We are no longer working in cohort. And anytime you see three, you know, cohorts going on. We're no longer working in this Trinitarian kind of pattern. We're now working individually. So cohort has just been destroyed. So we've gone from cohort to no king. So from cohort to an absolute chaos, basically. Everyone going their own way. We notice in Judges 1:1 that they're asking God where to go and how to go. He tells them, and do they do it or not? They do. They go to battle. He says, "Judah shall go first," and so Judah goes. They actually follow his lead. They follow his lead from Judges 17 through 21. What are they doing? Follow their own lead. What the key verse, really, and this is the key verse of Judges, is... In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And you should have seen that clearly in 17 through 21, right? We have the Levite priest, looking for a place to be a priest. We will go in, we will delve into 1721 at the end, but really, the Levite priest is looking for a place to be a priest? Okay, right away. And he's going to go to the highest bidder. We have another priest traveling all over the country with his concubines. I mean, we have the oddest stories. And you're going to see how those actually fit into exactly opposite of what, where they're called to be. Everybody's going their own way. Nobody is listening to anybody. So we have, we start out in cohort. We start out listening to God's voice to let him lead to everyone's on their own. Everyone's independent. It's chaotic and everyone's going their own way. We also have the sons of Israel coming together with God. And what is happening? So that means all 12 tribes. What's happening in 17 through 21 to the tribes?
They're actually fighting each other.
Yeah, they're actually fighting each other and killing each other. Yeah. Right?
Exiling, getting rid of.
Getting rid of them, right. Exactly. So not only do we not have unity, we literally have them killing each other off. So the farthest end that you can go. So we have from unity to disunity, to individual independence. The contrast here, and this is what you're supposed to get from this, the contrast from Judges 1:1 to Judges 21:25 is they, what does God want us to do? And at the end is, what do we want to do? Right? What does God want us to do? Well, what do we want to do? That's the journey that we're going to be taking from Judges 1 to Judges 21. That's the journey, and we're going to see it unfold seemingly very quickly to what do we want to do. So that's kind of the big picture of what is going on with Judges, the whole book of Judges. And this is something you need to understand as the narrative unfolds. When we tell our stories, we aren't always real good with the chronology of it, right? Because we'll start telling the story, and then we'll kind of back up and go, oh, wait, you know, I fill in more details, and then go back and forwards. That's what's happening here. So they start with a big picture, and now they're going to go to details. Now they're going to tell you the story again, but now they're going to give you some details of really what is happening here. So we have, starting in Judges 1, verses 3 and on, Judah is chosen to go first. So just for background, so you know, Judah will always be chosen to go first. God made a promise through Jacob to Judah. Does anybody know this blessing? That Judah would be the ruler of the tribes. So Judah will always be chosen by God to go first. So in other words, Judah is our leader here. Judah is the one who's going to kind of be the prototype for what we should be doing as image bearers. So Judah goes first, and he begins really well. First of all, he's vulnerable, right? He asks Simeon to help him. This is great, guys. This is not a, and I've seen some commentators say, oh, he didn't obey. Well, God never said. In fact, God said, be a cohort. I want you to be involved with one another. So this is a great thing. Judah's being vulnerable to say, I don't think I can handle this on my own. I'm going to cohort to help. Simeon, come with me, and then I'll help you. So this is a good thing. So he's vulnerable and asks Simeon to help. Then we see it says that the Lord gave to them. He gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they defeated 10,000 men at Bezek. So not only are they experiencing cohort, but now they're experiencing God's presence and God's work on their behalf. They're actually experiencing that. They go in, they go into battle together, and they experience victory. They experience that God is actually working there. This is great. So we have a great start to Judges. In verse 6, what's the first word?
But.
So it only takes us 5 verses to get from, I'm in cohort, I'm following God's lead, I'm listening to but. And you're going to notice that word a lot in Judges. But. And what does it say? But Adonai Bezek, who is it means Lord of Bezek, the king of Bezek, fled. And they pursued and caught him, and what did they do? What was God's direction for them to do? Utterly destroy. Utterly destroy. What they did, and Joshua gives them this from the very beginning of Joshua and the end speech of Joshua as he's dying. He says, go, utterly destroy, do all I command you to do, and do not what? Turn to the left or to the right. Don't look any other way but straight ahead at where God's leading you. And what do they do is they turn to the left here. Or the right, whichever. As soon as I put that down, I thought somebody's going to have a problem with that. they looked to the left rather than God. They've now changed their orientation. And what did they look at? They look at what's everybody else doing? They're looking at the most powerful. So let me stop here for just a second. Do we ever do that? To decide where to go, do we look, what is everybody else doing? Okay, so a lot. Let's talk about just driving. When we're driving, let's say you are coming to an intersection and you want to turn left. How do you do that? Okay, so you signal. Great. You get in your left lane, then what do? Let's say it's a busy intersection and cars are coming. Wait, where do you wait?
In the middle of the intersection.
In the middle of the intersection. Do you, Heather? Is that where you wait?
Yeah.
Anybody else do that?
No.
How many people wait in the middle of the intersection to turn left? Okay.
Because then you know you can go.
Yes.
On the yellow.
Yeah.
On the yellow.
And I go further and further.
Okay.
You wait for the little green arrow.
So, I just did this weekend. I was busy intersection. I pulled up waiting for a clear thing, but I pulled up into the intersection. As soon as I saw it was clear, I went. And out of the blue, I got completely smeared. And I went turning and turning.
Oh my God.
The policeman came, the other guy coming, the light had turned red. So I went, and the other guy went through a red light.
Oh.
Completely smashed me. Cars are totaled. And the policeman came and talked with us and said, you know, where were you? I'm in the middle of the intersection turning left. He goes, and you're getting a ticket. Why? And this just, like, I can't believe. Of course, I'm teaching judges. Because you did not yield the right of way. You didn't yield your power. You didn't give up your power. That's illegal. You are to wait behind the line. The only law, every single state has that law. Every single state. The other man did exactly what he, and what was I doing? And I said, but everybody does that. Everybody, right? Everybody sits in the middle of that.
There. Well, yeah.
Exactly. Everybody does this. But that's not the law. What was I doing? I'm looking what everybody else does, right? I'm looking what everybody else does. So was the other man, right? Coming through the red light. Everybody tries to beat the light. Maybe less than people that are in the intersection, but you try to beat the light. What happens when everybody does what everybody else does? When everybody does what they think is right in their own eyes?
They all run into each other.
Yeah. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. There is going to be a crash. There is going to be a crash. No matter how many times you've sat in that intersection and nothing's happened, there will be a crash. It's the first accident I've ever had in my entire life.
Are you okay?
Scary.
I'm sore. But I'm miraculously okay.
What intersection?
Boughton and 53.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It is so imperative that we understand what God is saying here. Doing what's right in your own eyes, it may work time after time after time, but there will come a time that you will crash. Because it isn't, I've asked you and I've told you, the best thing for image bearing and for everyone to flourish is for you to yield the right away. It's for you to actually follow my directions, not your own. What happens here with Judah is they look away. They do what everyone else has done. They look and see, well, what's everybody doing here? Okay. I'm just glad that isn't like the court or the. Judah looks at what is everybody else doing. And in fact, he doesn't only look at everybody. He looks at specific people. Who does he look at? The powerful people. The people who are successful. Which is exactly what we do, right? Well, they're successful in doing that. Everybody goes into the intersection. Everybody seems, in fact, there was a man in front of me doing the same thing. Who, God was very gracious. Actually, as he passed, he turned around, went in the parking lot, came out and ran to me and said, I saw what happened, I will be your witness. Wow. He did exactly what I did. And he was willing to tell the policeman that after the policeman told us, if you're in the intersection, you get a ticket. And he was willing to still stand up for me. He could have gotten a ticket. They didn't give him, I don't think they gave him one, but we always look at what everybody else does, and particularly we look at who's successful, right? If they're successful in doing this, well, then that must be the way I should go. So I'll do that. So Judah looks at Adonai Bezek. That's who he looks at. What has Adonai Bezek done? What has he done when he captures his enemies? Cuts off their toes and their thumbs. So what does Judah do? Does the same thing, right? He cuts off the toes and the thumbs. Instead of doing what God said, utterly destroy, he cuts off their toes and their thumb. Now, here's the interesting thing. You peel this apart and you realize what's happening and the big mistake Judah has made. So, he looks at what Adonai Bezek has done. And what he has done is he's practiced a life that is exactly opposite of image bearing. So if we go back to what image bearing is, right? Names with for worth, tens, multiplies for flourishing. This is exactly opposite of what Adonai Bezek has done with the things. So first of all, he cut off the thumbs and toes of these other rulers that he's conquered. In other words, he makes them no longer fit to rule. They can no longer rule. And here's just an aside for any of you guys who were in Leviticus. Anything yes. familiar? Yeah, what?
Well, part of the covenant for the priest is the blood on the ears so I could hear God's voice, the thumb so I can do as well, and the toe so that I can go where he wants me to go.
Yep. What is really happening here is Adonai Bezek is making sure they cannot be priests. He is not naming worth. He's taking away worth. You can't be a ruler anymore. You see what's happening? He's doing exactly opposite of what an image bearer does. He's taking away their ability to rule, to be priests, to be image bearers. He then is also shaming them, right? Because he makes them beg for what they need. They have to beg for food. That's the opposite of tending, of giving what is needed for you to become all you are meant to be. He makes them beg and be in shame. And then he subjugates them. He multiplies. He's got 70 kings doing this under his table. He is making them less and small. This is exactly what we said last week, right? I'm going to gather as many as possible and make them small, put them in a small place and diminish them rather than gathering people so that they can flourish and grow. So what Adonai Bezek does is just a practice of the world he lives in. It's, and we know it's a practice because he's done it 70 times. And it's a practice in order to build his own kingdom up, his own self up. So we have what Adonai Bezek is doing as a norm in the world. And Judah doesn't think anything of it because they've now looked at, oh, well, this is what the norm is. This is what everybody does. Everybody goes into the intersection. Not realizing, not yielding the right of way is not being an image bearer, but an idol bearer. And the last thing that happens is Adonai Bezek ascribes something to God. Now, they have it capitalized here. We have no idea. And in Hebrew, there aren't capitalizations, so we don't know. We have no idea if he's talking about the God or his God. It doesn't matter because what he is saying here is, he says, so God has, I've done this, so now God has repaid me. What he is saying is, the reason my life looks like this, the reason I have a practice like this, it starts with God. God has a transactional way with me. God repays what I do. If I do this, then he's going to do this. If I do this, he's going to do this. He is claiming that our paradigm, the way we live our paradigm, is because that's God's paradigm, that God is a transactional God. Is that true?
No.
No. God is not a transactional God. It's the whole purpose that Israel is supposed to clear these people out so that the people see God's not transactional. The problem is everybody's living as if God is transactional, and so that's what everybody believes. God's transactional. Do we believe that today? Absolutely. All the time, right? I had a car accident because I did something wrong. No, we're going to see. We're going to look. God is actually doing something in that. God is not transactional. He doesn't give tit for tat. But because we live that way and we say, and it's so clear right here, and Adonai Bezek says, well, but this is what God does. So of course this is how we live. And he's not questioning it at all. That's just how it is. Everything's transactional. So here, this huge lie that Adonai Bezek lives, Judah is now partaking of. Do you see how dangerous it is for Judah to look at what everybody else is doing? How dangerous it is for us to look at what everybody else is doing rather than what God has told us to? Because then we begin to live a lie, and we begin to not be image bearers, but actually we destroy image bearing by just taking a small look. What's interesting is that we continue on with the story. So that's just this little piece of story. And if you don't know Genesis 1, if you don't know what our purpose is and what Israel's purpose is, you don't quite understand what's going on here. And you wonder, why do we have this story about cutting off the thumbs and the big toes? And yet everyone of those Israelites should have known the big toes and the thumbs are places where the priests get anointed. Wait. This is God. It should have stopped them. But they were looking at what everybody else is doing to their enemies. Oh, so that we must do that too. So the story goes on. And we realize that now Judah is continuing to fight and actually having success, right? They're actually defeating some of the Canaanites in Hebron. And they're going against Debir. And we're going to skip Caleb's story for just a minute, and we go down and we realize that in 16, not only are they having success with their battles, but they're having success with inviting to the cohort already, because we have the Kenites deciding that they're going to live with the Judahites, live with the sons of Israel. This is great. These are all great things and good things. The problem is, in the midst of the story, Judah looked to the left. But now they're still having success. So our temptation is to say, well, so see, it doesn't really matter. It's not a big deal that they look to the left. It was just a small look. It wasn't a big deal. Because they still have success. This is kind of what we do now, right? We say, well, we see a leader or a group not bearing image, not naming with worth, not tending, not multiplying for flourishing. And we say, but look at all God is doing there still. So it's okay. We don't have to really say anything about that. We don't really have to do anything about that because God's still working. Remembering the patience of God and that he needs to continue to work through, we forget that every look away from God will always have consequences and will always cause the path to look a little differently. So notice that we still have a little bit of success for Judah, even after he's looked away, but you can be sure it's going to come up. So now let's go back to the story. Right in there, they have an insertion of the story about Caleb and Othniel and Aksa. Really my favorite story. We have Caleb. Remember who Caleb is, right? He is the partner to Joshua, who was one of the spies who said it was okay to go in. He was one of the courageous ones. He's been a great fighter. He has done exactly what God has called him to do all through the book of Joshua. He's done the same thing that Joshua's done. And he's followed God's command. Yep, I'm going in and fighting, and we're victorious. And he keeps on being victorious. Now he's older, and he is probably not able to fight anymore, so he's going to encourage the next generation. Fight. Go in and fight. Get rid of these places where idol-bearing is being encouraged. Go and do it. And he offers an incentive. I will give my daughter Aksa. That's not unusual for the Eastern world. This was just a, come on, let's do what God sent us to do. Let's go ahead and do it. And so we have Othniel saying that he's going to do it. We'll talk a little bit more about Othniel next week. But Othniel says, yes, I'm going to take that up. I'm going to do it. The interesting thing, both the name Caleb and Othniel both mean pretty much the same thing. It means forceful. Yes, I want to do it. I want to take what God has said for us to do, and I want to do it. I want to grab onto it and do it. So both Caleb encourages, Othniel takes up his encouragement, and he actually continues to do that. He takes on Caleb's example. So Othniel gets Aksa as his wife, and now we have Aksa do exactly what Caleb has done and Othniel has done. She takes up the same thing. I'm not going to be satisfied with just a little piece of what God's given us. I want everything that God's given us. I want the streams so that it can flourish, the land that you've given. What she does here, and this is a really beautiful small picture. What we have here is Aksa, who is now a bride, right? She's now a bride, and she decides that she is going to take what her husband has fought for and her father has given and embrace it and take it all. Does that sound like anybody else? Who? Like maybe the bride of Christ who fought for an abundant life for you that God wants to give you and say, yes, I want it all. I want all of the life you want to give me to flourish. That's the example of Aksa. This is a breath of fresh air in the midst of Judah kind of going downhill. Is Caleb and Othniel and Aksa are all doing exactly what God has called them to do. Hold on to what I've given you and take it all. I want you to have the abundant life. I don't want you to be settled. I don't want you to settle for those mud pies on the shore. I want you to have it all. And I want you to go in and grab that. So it's interesting. Aksa's name actually means coiled as an asp. Snake. One of the snakes that what? Seize and eat it up. This is a positive picture. This is Aksa wanting what God's given her. Wanting what her husband has fought for. She wants it all. She wants to take it in. It's the desire that actually God is putting in our heart. The desire for a whole life. The desire for Zoe to be completely connected and open and flowing in our life so that it drives to Game Bios. That's the picture that we have of Aksa there. So that is interesting that really one of the first people who takes a hold in Judges is this woman, right? And we're going to see this throughout Judges, is some of the women are going to take hold of what God wants for them. This beautiful land and a beautiful, abundant life. So, it's a, kind of a, like, there were some people wanting to do this. It just wasn't the majority of people. So, now it goes back then to the story of Judah. So, we have Judah, of course, Judah and Simeon utterly destroying some places. Judah taking Gaza and Ashkelon, which is interesting that Judah takes them, because we will find out. And it's interesting, all of the places, the geography here is interesting because you need to know either what's happened before there or what is going to happen later there. And Ashkelon is going to come in again. Gaza continues to be a problem today, right? There's still problems there for Israel. So we have Judah taking Gaza and Ashkelon with his territory. It says, now the Lord was with Judah. Okay, big point, right? Because what God is trying to tell us here is, I'm with you and I'm working for you. So it says, God was with Judah. Judah understood that. And they took possession of the hill country. What do you see next? But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley. Why? Because they had iron chariots. Okay, that verse should have stopped you and said, yeah. What? The Lord is with them, but they couldn't do it because there were iron chariots? What is going on here? Where are they looking right now? What excuse are they giving for not being able to possess? Right, iron chariots. They're looking at the iron chariots. They're too strong. All of a sudden, again, they're looking at other places. They're looking at the strength of the enemy. Iron chariots, anytime you see iron chariots in scripture, it's always this idea of power and strength. Here's an interesting thing, though, about that. Where had their fathers come from? Egypt, right? How did they get out of Egypt?
They walked out,
and who was chasing them? Pharaoh and all of his chariots. Guess what? The chariots of Pharaoh are the standard for power. Their fathers had seen God defeat the standard for power, the strongest in the world. And now they're looking at iron chariots going, oh, but they have iron chariots. God's with me, but they have iron chariots. Because they keep looking at the iron chariots rather than God is with me. So you see how big a difference it makes? You look once at what everybody else is doing, you're going to look twice. Because your magnetic north is always going to go toward, there's other stuff out there. I'm always going to be looking other stuff. So even though God was working, they were getting victory, even though God was present, because their sight got distracted by the power of men, rather than the power of God. It distracted them completely from what had happened in Egypt, right? And we're going to see kind of why that would have happened. And because it got distracted and looked at the power of men, they forgot to look at the power of God and that that was their source of strength.
But Jill, we see, I mean, it's funny because it might as well be a fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because like you look back and you're like, you see Sarah like, oh great, you're going to give me this.
Exactly.
Or like Peter in the water. You know what I'm saying? Like, but this is deep water. Like, it's almost a fill in the blank of what we are looking at.
Yes,
exactly. To be an iron chariot.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. It's always, but this is too strong. This is too big. This is too hard. This is not fair. This is whatever. Instead of, God is with me. God is working. So that's what's happening here with Judah. And so we have, what is they're not able to do now? Now they're not able to drive out the inhabitants. Now they're not able to make the space for them to live and become models of image bearing. So they have not only failed themselves, but we're going to see. Remember who Judah is? They're the leader. They're the ones who are supposed to go first to show the rest of the tribes, so the rest of the tribes could show the rest of the world. And they have looked elsewhere, and so they have failed to be able to do that. So we see, as the chapter goes on, that others follow their lead. All the rest of the tribes follow their lead. Judah goes first. Judah's their leader. Whatever Judah does, they do. And they'll say, well, we're going to follow their lead because isn't that what we're supposed to? God chose them as leaders, so shouldn't we follow them? And God always says, and who is the leader in the cohort? God is the leader in the cohort. You look to God for the leadership. I'm asking Judah to go first, but always your direction comes from God. It means that all the tribes afterwards that looked to Judah and followed Judah, it means they also then were looking to the left. They were also looking at what everybody else is doing in the culture that they're in, which means they're also going to reap the same thing. They're trying to draw their power from another source rather than God. I've been the source of power. I've had your father's defeat and defeat and defeat. Biggest, strongest enemy there is in the world at that time, Egypt, has been completely defeated. And all you needed to do was follow me. And they've defeated for a couple hundred years with Joshua. And now they're turning to the right or to the left. What we see here is if you read through this, we see Judah could not drive out, even though the Lord was with him. Benjamin did not drive out, and they lived among the enemies. The house of Joseph did not drive out, and they lived among. Manasseh did not drive out, and they lived among and forced enemy into labor. Ephraim did not drive out and lived among the enemy. Zebulun did not drive out and lived among and forced enemy into labor. Asher did not drive out and lived among the enemy. Naphtali did not drive out and lived among and forced them into labor. What do we have here? Another rhythm, right? A completely different rhythm. And the rhythm is not create and rest. It's just the opposite. They're not creating here. They could not drive out. They're doing just the opposite. They're not making space to be able to name and tend and multiply to flourish. The interesting thing about the rhythm is the first three shows that it's going to escalate, because it starts with Judah could not drive out because they looked away even though the Lord was with them. Benjamin could not drive out and lived among the enemy. The house of Joseph did not drive out. They looked away and lived among. So what you see is a little bit of an escalation. So what you know is this isn't going to be a pattern that just goes like this. It's going to be a pattern that goes like this. It's going to go down and down and down. Same pattern, but it's going to go further and further down, further and further away from being image bearers. So that's what we see in that. Anytime you see something repeated over and over again, go back and look. What's God trying to tell you in this story about what's happening? And we see that a new rhythm is being produced, that this is going to be the rhythm that they're going to be living with. At the end of the rhythm, we have Dan. And does it either say Dan does not drive out or lives among or forces the enemy? What does it say happens to Dan?
Forced out.
Oh, now it just flipped. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Dan did not drive out. Now it's Dan is being driven out. You stay in that rhythm long enough, you're going to be consumed by the rhythm. And it's going to happen. And that kind of switches to like, oh, and now the cycle is going to begin again, and we come back to the house of Joseph, and now the house of Joseph is going to force enemies into labor. Why would you force your enemies into labor? What would be the purpose? Why would you make people slaves for you?
For your own good.
For your own good, your own use, right? What is Israel there to do?
Utterly destroy,
to make a space so that everyone can flourish. And they're doing just the opposite. We want to diminish everybody. That's what's happening to them. They don't do what God has told them to do. They do exactly the opposite. And when they do anything but what God's told them to do, it will always be the opposite of image bearing. So what is happening is Israel is fully assimilating to the new rhythm. They're not creating. They're not making space for flourishing. They did not drive out. But they're squeezing into a place. They're coming, they're living among, fitting into a small place that diminishes. I'll just squeeze in here, and I'll just try to make myself, you know, comfortable here and put my little walls around, because they're living in a place with lots and lots of walls, right? I'll just put my walls here, and they're not going to connect. They're not multiplying so that people can flourish. They're forcing their enemy into labor so that they diminish. So they're not doing anything God has asked them to do. They need, at this point, to reorient, right? Adjust their focus. Lift their eyes from seeing and following what's happening in the world to seeing and following what God is doing. So we come to the end of chapter 1. And we get into chapter 2. And what the author or the editor does is puts this together and kind of stops. He stops the narrative, the story, long enough for us to kind of behold what's going on. Let's take a look at it from another perspective, from different eyes. Let's take our blinders off from what we see and from Judah looking. What does man see is happening with Israel? And what does God see? So what we have is really the same story being told in 1 and 2 from man's perspective and from God's perspective. It's kind of what they did in Genesis, right? Genesis 1, we have God's perspective, and Genesis 2, we have man's perspective. We actually see this a lot in Scripture. The same story is being told. It's not two different stories. It's different perspective. And so that's what's happening in Joshua, or in Judges 2, is now we're going to look at kind of the same idea of what's going on, but we're going to look at what does God say is really happening here. So, what's the very first sentence of Judges 2? Now the angel of the Lord came. Now this is odd, right? The angel of the Lord came from one place to another. Where did he come from? Where is he going?
Came from Gilgal to Bochim.
Okay, came from Gilgal to Bochim. Some of you should remember Gilgal, right?
Roll away.
Yeah.
What was that?
Kristen?
Rolled away the
reproach.
The reproach.
Right.
Yeah.
So Gilgal.
They got circumcised there.
They got circumcised there. They did a lot of stuff there. Gilgal is where they crossed the Jordan. And how did they cross the Jordan?
To the priest team.
Right. The priest went first, right? Stood in the water, the waters receded, dry land, the million people of Israel walked across Jordan into the promised land. They just walked right in. And there, from that place of the Jordan, they took up 12 stones. And what did they do with those 12 stones? They built a memorial, right? So they brought them onto the shore from the middle. From the middle of the flooded Jordan, they brought them out so that they would have a memorial place. And what were they to do with that memorial place?
Tell the children.
Yeah. They were to use that as a prompt to tell the stories of where they had seen God's presence and his working in their lives. That's what Gilgal is. That's where so the angel's movement here is, look, this is where you started out. You started out with God's presence with you and his working with you, and you're committing to continuing to tell the stories of how God works and where that he's always there with us. You committed to that. You experienced all of that. That's where Gilgal is. And we need to stop for a minute here, because stories are really important. Notice that almost 80% of the Old Testament is stories. And there's a reason for that. It's also the reason I love Old Testament. If I have to teach, I'm going to teach Old Testament. Stories allow people to enter into the experience. So, if I tell you some facts about growing up, I had three sisters, I grew up in Dalton, I went to Iliana Christian High School because there was race riots. You now know some facts about me, right? But you don't know me. If I start telling you my stories, the stories about each of my sisters, and I give you all these great stories about my sisters, and then the stories about how I had to go to a Christian school, my parents weren't Christians, and it came because there were race riots where I was supposed to go, and here I'm in this new school, and I flourish in this new school. If I start telling you my stories, all of a sudden, you enter into my experience, right? It now becomes actually a part of your experience. I have a friend, I hope she doesn't mind me telling this, but I have a friend who tells me this story that I literally feel, because she's told me the story, that I've been there. She tells me a story that she grew up with a life-size figurine of Jesus laying on her bed. That it was there every day and it had to be there every day. And you know what? I know exactly what that baby Jesus looked like. I know what the bedroom looks like. Like, there are times when I think, well, I've seen it, right? Like, has someone ever told you their story enough or vividly enough that sometimes you think maybe you actually were there? Yeah, you experienced it, right? That's what Israel was supposed to do with what God had done with them. Those 12 memorial stones, they were there to prompt them to tell the stories so that their sons and daughters could enter into the experience of God being in their presence and working for them. And that was really important, and we will see that in a second. That's where the angel's coming from. This is where you started. You made a commitment to do this. You saw God work. You saw that God was there. And the interesting thing is, they're going to go into battles with gusto. Like, from here on in, Joshua, they never once were like, oh, I don't want to go into battle. Oh, I just want to just live in a little space. No, they were like all in because they had experienced that God was with them. They were looking at God and his power. Now they're at Bochim. And Bochim is a place where they're going, oh, we are in such a terrible place. This is so horrible. I hate being here. They're lamenting and moaning about the consequences of what they have been doing, looking the other ways. And now they're in the midst of all these enemies. And oh, there was none of this in Joshua. Now they're moaning. And God is saying, this is where you were, and this is where you are. How did you get here? What have you been doing? God says, this is what I've been doing. I've been staying the same the whole time. I will never break covenant, ever. Keeping covenant, which is a mutually dependent relationship, is exactly what God is all about. And it is a key for us understanding Judges, for us to understand that God, every action God does, is about keeping covenant. It is about keeping a mutually dependent relationship vibrant. So everything he does, and it's so important you know this, because you're going to come, just in a couple of verses, you're going to come with verses like, what? Always say to you, this is God keeping covenant. This is God keeping covenant. This is God keeping covenant. This is why he says this. Hey, guys, you know I will always be keeping covenant. That's what I'm about. I'm always doing that. I will always work for your freedom. Always. So he says, I brought you out of Egypt. That's what I always do. I'm always bringing you out of bondage. I'm always bringing you out of the small places. And I led you to a large place. That's what I'm always doing. I'm always leading you to a large place. I'm always bringing you to freedom, to spaciousness, to a place where you can flourish. That's what I'm doing now. So anytime you say, what in the world is God doing here? You can answer, God is bringing me to freedom. God is leading me to a place where I can flourish. No matter what he's doing, that's the underneath. The action of covenant is that he is letting them have space to follow or not. Because remember, God freely creates, and us being his image, we need to be able to freely create. He's bringing us to a place where we get to choose. He is not bringing us to a place that he forces. It's why it's always an open space. And we're going to see some of the words that actually mean to open the space up. He will always bring us to a space where we get to choose. Yet he will never leave them. I always think it's interesting that when we go back to Genesis and we talk about the fall and Adam and Eve being put out of the garden, even last night in my class, the professor said this, and I wanted to say, I don't think that's true. Because he says they were put out of God's presence. First of all, it never says that. Second of all, what do we know God does? He follows them right out. He doesn't stay in this confined garden, does he? He follows them out, and we see them over and over and over again. God is following them out. God is leading them through. God will never leave us, but he will honor our choices. If we want to take the thorny path, he'll let us take the thorny path. And he will use that thorny path as an invitation back. This reminds me so much of the story of Hosea and Gomer. So if you've been in class long enough, we've gone through Hosea. So Gomer was a prostitute, and God told Hosea to marry her. She continues to leave him and be a prostitute. And God says, you keep going after her. Go after her. And at some point, go after her and now bring her to the wilderness, bring her to the desert, so that she can, a couple things. Number one, understand where her life is leading, to the desert, to nothing, to no life. But also, as she is experiencing this no life, this wilderness, she can now hear you. And she can hear the gentle words. And of course, we have this kind of almost like a dream, like that Hosea becomes God, right? God's voice speaking to Gomer in gentle ways. Is this what you really want? You can come back to me. Is this what you want? You can come back to me. So what we have is God saying, I'll let you take the thorny path, and I'll let you experience it fully, that it's not bringing you life. I'll let you experience how hard those thorns are. And I'll be right there saying, is this really what you want? Or do you want to come back to me? Do you want to come back where that life is full and abundant? This is what God's saying when he says, I will never break my covenant with you. What has the choice of Israel been? It's to not follow God's lead. They have covenanted with another. I think it says forsake here, right? So they forsake means to abandon. They have abandoned their promise to be in cohort with God, and they have decided to connect themselves with whatever will allow them to lead their own lives, whatever will allow their suke or their bios to lead and control their life. They've squeezed into a cramped place because they've left the altars up, right? Which means they've allowed idol bearing everywhere. I'll just fit in somewhere here. It's okay, whatever's going on there. I'll just fit in here and I'll just be okay right here. And this really is such a picture of our individualized Western Christianity, right? It's very individual, right? It's all about the individual. Never in Scripture does it say that you can be a believer and follow Christ on your own, ever. You can't do that. And this is the beautiful picture of it doesn't work that way. And they don't listen to the voice of God. So the choice of Israel is to not be faithful. Because their magnetic pull, every time they look at it, it becomes more and stronger and bigger, and they just can't resist that magnetic pull. So that's the big picture, how God sees it. This is how God sees it. I've kept covenant, and I will always keep covenant, and you've not kept covenant. Now let's go into detail, he says. So in Judges 1, we had the same thing. We had a big picture, and then we had a small picture from man's perspective. Now God's doing the same thing. Here's the big picture. Now let's do the detailed picture. And we'll revisit the path. So we have starting out in verse 6. So understanding that what they're going to give you context now. This is where you started out with Joshua. You were looking at me. You were following my lead. You knew exactly what your purpose was. You knew that your purpose was to possess the land, completely and wholly possess the land so that you could set up a lifestyle of image bearing. And you also understood how you were to do that, and that was by serving the Lord, allowing him to lead, allowing you holding up his weight and glory, and he'll hold up your weight and glory. That's cohort. And they were able to do that because they saw him work, and they could hear his voice. In the desert, they were alone and dependent only on him. They've come into the land, and they see only him. They're looking at him, and so they're very successful in following Joshua into the land. Now what's happening, so that's 6 through 9, and then in 10, anytime you're telling a narrative, right, you have a plot, and all of a sudden you have an emergency, right? Something happens that makes the whole plot turn. That's verse 10. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers. So all the people that followed and were looking at God had died. And there arose another generation after them who did not know, and that is experience, the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. So let's talk about this generation. It's a generation that lived in peace. So this generation was the generation that lived after their fathers had conquered a lot of the land. So Joshua and all of that generation had been fighting. And at the end of Joshua, it says, and the Lord gave them rest on every side. I think that's in 21 maybe of Joshua. So the Lord gave them rest on every side, and every promise did not fail. So what we have is a generation that is living in peace, in rest, in actually prosperity, because they have now been able to build cities on the rubble, and they're living in these cities. Now there's more enemies to conquer, but this generation has been living in the peaceful time. So it's really important to understand. It is in the peaceful time when those stories are really important. Because they are now not experiencing God doing miraculously victorious things against their enemies, right? They're living in peace and rest. So this is the time when those fathers need to bring them to Gilgal and say, you see this memorial? Here's my story about what God did with me. And what they are to be doing is not just giving the facts. God opened the river, we walked through, we conquered, and here we are. They know the facts. They need to tell the stories. You know what God did? Eli the priest was standing there, and I saw his robe wasn't wet at all. And they're telling their stories. This is the time. This is why when we talk about rest and Sabbath, it's a time for connecting with the stories of what God has done. It's resting time is for us to share our stories of what God has done. Very specifically and deep, which is kind of what we're trying to do in our groups. Starting to share our stories. And all of a sudden, and I just sat in one group and I noticed that we actually entered into who that person was more than we did when we have just asked questions or when we just asked them certain little things. They started telling us their stories, And now, I hope most of you have a little bit of a picture of who that person is. This is what they should have been doing during this time of rest. So this young generation that's coming up, they only knew rest and prosperity. In Deuteronomy, what does God say to them? When you go into the land and you have been prosperous and things have gone really well for you, what does he say? Be careful, because you will be tempted to think you got that way because of your great strength. Make sure you tell the stories of how God delivered you and how God's strength was there, because otherwise you will begin to think it's your strength. That's what's happening to this generation. They had not personally experienced it, and they did not vicariously experience it because their fathers had not shared the stories. They had not kept their commitment to tell the stories of what God had done and where God had been with them.
Does that mean they weren't having the holy days and stuff like
okay,
that?
Okay, so that's really interesting. We will actually get there in those 17 through 21.
Okay.
We're going to look at, but start looking to see if you see any pattern of that. And I'm not going to give you the full answer for that, but whether they were or they weren't, what we know because of what's happening to this generation is, if they were, it was obligation. It was facts. It was, we're resting because God told us to rest. No stories. It was, we're celebrating this feast because of this. It was just, well, we're supposed to do this. So it was going through the moral obligations rather than entering in an experience. We're going to see that in the prophets all the time, right? The prophets are yelling at Israel all the time. You are only going through the motions. You're not entering in. And it starts in Judges. So, but look for that. Look and see if you see any patterns of them celebrating Sabbath and the holy days that were prescribed in Deuteronomy.
It sort of happened at Exodus too, because they kept not remembering all these great miracles that were happening.
Right, right. So the remembering has not been happening, and now we're getting into how it's really affecting their lives. So we see a generation that does not see God's presence or his works, because they're in rest, in prosperity, and because the older generation is not sharing their stories. You should really think about that. Like, how do we do the body of Christ nowadays? Do we just tell them the facts? Or do we share the stories? You know, most of you know some of my story, and some of my story is that when I was on staff at a church, I was told not to tell my stories. Don't tell people what's going on in your life, because we want them to think that you're perfect. Worst thing you could have said to me. Because that's my magnetic north. And so God brings things like accidents and tragedies. But that's what's happening. And I think it's still happening. And so because they don't know God, they don't see him, they're going to look elsewhere. And they're going to do how Judges puts it, they're going to do evil in God's sight. Notice there, remember our key word is sight. God sees it. They're not looking at God, but God's looking at them. God is still there, and they're thinking he's not. And we're going to see that in some of the ways that the conversations come up, like, well, where have you been, God? Right here we know God's still there. He's still seeing it. He knows what's going on. So we need to understand, we always have to go back to that word evil, because we have connotations of evil that, number one, our first connotation of evil is, that's not me, right? Because evil is something, right? That's not me.
Well, worse than me.
Worse than me, right, exactly. Worse than me. Evil, the actual word evil means to be of inferior quality. To be less than you were made to be. What does that sound like the opposite of?
Flourishing.
Yep. Opposite of flourishing. So when it says they do evil, it means they stop letting creation, people, animals, the earth, from being fully able to flourish, to fulfill the potential for who God has made them to be, for people to be image bearers, and for the rest of creation to be reflectors of who he is. All because they aren't breathing God's breath. They're not taking in Zoe. They're not letting his breath direct their life. That's what it means to do evil in God's sight. So then you have to go back and say, do I do evil in God's sight? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. You have to be very careful not to separate yourself when you read something like that. Because we do, right? When we say someone is evil, what are we thinking? We're thinking the worst deprivation ever, right? What is God thinking? You're not flourishing. You're not allowing me to make you an image bearer. That's evil. Independent. I'm letting myself, my suke or my bios lead me. I'm not letting Zoe lead me to image bearing life. That's what evil is. That's what's happening in this. I want us to be so careful because in Judges, we are so, and I'll bet you did this. When you read 17 through 21, your thought was like, oh man, that's not anything in my experience, right? That's horrible. That's terrible. I can't imagine living in a life like that. You better get used to the fact that Judges is about us, and that's where we live. And that's very indicative of where we are. So look at evil, understand what that means. I'm not flourishing as image bearer, and I'm refusing God's leading to be an image bearer. So a generation that did evil in God's sight, they forsook the Lord who brought them out. They abandoned his breath. They stopped letting him breathe into them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. They put God in emergency mode. They served the Baals by following their lead through the thorns. And really, and we do this all the time. When we're following our own idols, when we're following our own way, we're always like, yeah, this is hard, it's striving, but you know, it's worth it. The payoff is going to be worth it for me to strive hard, bowing to them, being submissive to the idea. We had that ad last week, that idea of, you know, got to work on seventh day, got to use the seventh day for cleaning. You know, because more productivity, right? Rest means I'm not going to be productive enough. We say things, you know, like, it's good to be out of breath, or this is what we say all the time, right? No pain, no gain. Right? And I'll bet any money every one of you has said that at one time or another. And God's saying, you know, I actually have a life, I have a way for you that it's not going to feel so painful. Jesus said, my burden's really light. You want to keep carrying that heavy burden? Okay, I'll be with you in it, and I'm going to make it so that you understand that there's a way, a path that's not so burdensome, not so thorny. So let's look at God's emergency response. So it says it provoked God to anger. It made him go into emergency mode. It says in 14 that his anger burned. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel. We always have, I love the way that we come up with these ideas for certain things. And anger burned, we always have this connotation of that's a bad thing, right? The word there, anger, actually means it refers to the breathing part of the face, particularly the nose, and the nose when it flares out. Now, I want you to think about this. This is an emergency. So the first thing God does, and remember, this is anthropomorphism, so it's obviously God doesn't physically do this. This is a way to describe what's going on for God. God's nostrils open up, and he forces out more breath. What's happening? He's seeing they're not breathing. So he forces himself to breathe out more breath into them. The burning is that initial flare-up when you first ignite a flame. It means to be zealous. It is like God seeing they've been on the path of thorns, and all of a sudden they aren't breathing. I don't know how many of you have ever had to give CPR to someone who's not breathing. Anybody? Yeah, it's a really scary thing. And you go into mode of they're not breathing. It doesn't matter what has happened. It doesn't matter if they caused not breathing or something else caused not breathing. You're not making any judgment calls there, right? You are like, they're not breathing. I am going to do whatever, and it's going to be forceful. Whatever you do is going to be forceful. If you've ever seen a paramedic perhaps do it, it's forceful. This is what it's trying to get across. God's anger burned. It's not, we think of our anger, which is not very righteous. His is like, I got to get more breath out of here. They're not breathing. And the only way they're going to get breath is me. I've got to get more breath out. And so his nose flares to force that out. I'm going to get breath into them. I'm zealous for them to be able to breathe. How does he do that? How does he breathe more breath into them? Well, he does it in ways that we're not going to do. We're not going to choose. But certainly paramedics choose to do this. He says he gave them to plunderers. The word gave there actually means to deliver, to make a place. He's going to concentrate heavily on the place that is in trouble, the place that you're suffocating. I have got to attack that place. I have got to absolutely give you into that place so that I can open it up. And it says he sold them to their enemies. The word sell there actually means to sell as merchandise. He's saying to them, you've chosen a transactional paradigm. So he's going to treat them as such. You want to be merchandise? Okay, here's how it feels. Is this really what you want? He's going to give them the opportunity to experience what it's like to be merchandise. And ask them, with his presence and his breath, is it what you want? Do you want to be merchandise? Do you want to be in a place that is a place hard to breathe? You've chosen to live among them. It's your choice. You chose to be in a small, squished place where you can't stand any longer, where you can hardly breathe. I'm here with you because I want you to answer the question, is this really what you want? And then it says in 15, and this is where I remember, keep saying, what's God doing here? He's fulfilling covenant. He's bringing us to freedom. He's leading us to a place where we can be image bearers. Because in 15 it says, wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was what?
Against them
for evil. Well, that's an interesting statement, isn't it? What he's doing is allowing them to feel the extent of being of inferior quality. Diminished merchandise. Wherever they went, if they tried to escape, he was going to make sure they felt it. I want you to feel what it feels like not to be able to breathe. I want you to feel that, not as a punishment, but so that you rethink your choice. Is this really what you want? Because this is what this life has for you. This is what a transactional life has for you. This is what an idol-bearing life has for you. A life where your suke and your bios lead, this is where it's leading to. I want you to experience that. I want you not to be able to stand. I don't want you to remain comfortable in this small place. I want you to be able to say, I don't want this anymore. And as long as there is rest and peace, you will gradually fall into death and you'll never know it. I want you to feel it. And it says, so they were severely distressed. I want you to fully feel what it's like to live in a narrow, confining place where it's hard to breathe. I want you to experience the failure of what you've chosen. I want to discredit the idols, your way, what you think is right. I want to discredit that as giving you life. Discredit the lie that it says you can control your own life and do what you think is right without being connected to me. I want you to experience that, and I'm going to be right there saying, do you want that? Is that what you really want? Are you sure that's what you want? That's how he gives you more breath. He wants to make sure you understand your choice. And so he will allow you to follow your choice so that you experience it. How many times? Okay, so what is the generation of parents called in the last couple of years that send their kids off to college? Helicopter parents. What does that mean? They hover. They want to make sure that my child feels no pain, right? Oh, you need notebooks for college? Oh, I'll go get them for you. Oh, you need that for college? I'll get that for you, right? I don't want you to be distressed. Is that a loving way?
No.
Absolutely not. It's not how God treats us. God says, did I tell you the story about Bill Hybels where he talks about that? Right? That he says, his father said, figure it out, whatever it is. I never told you this story?
You did.
I did. Thank you.
Yeah.
At 11 years old, he put him on a train and says, you wanted to climb a mountain? Go figure it out. Puts him on a train to Colorado on his own, 11 years old. Figure it out. Yeah, we go, what? But doesn't that tell us exactly where we're at? We don't go, wow, great thing to do.
Well, I mean, all this is making me think just what you were saying last week of, like, here's a rhythm that God gave them. Now they went into this other rhythm, right? They're following this other rhythm. And they need interruption.
Right.
Right? They need some kind of interruption for the rhythm to be reframed.
Right.
And I just started thinking, like, isn't that kind of like jail in a way?
Yeah.
Like, we thought of it as like this total, like, you pay for your whatever.
Right.
But, like, really, isn't that just meant to be a giant interruption so you can reframe your rhythm?
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean?
Exactly, exactly. So all of these things, remember, God is always fulfilling covenant. He's always trying to bring you to a place of freedom. Again, giving you choice. Really? Is this really what you want to choose? Is this really something that you think you can live with the whole time? And then God, what does it say in 18. Then the Lord raised up judges. He didn't rescue them until they felt distressed, until they absolutely felt the full consequences of the choices they'd made. Then he rescues them. He wants them to feel it. I hope as a parent, you want your child to actually feel some of the consequences of what they're choosing. If you never allow them the consequences of what they're choosing, they will choose farther and farther their own way, right? And at some point, it will be really serious. God does that for us over and over again. That's a loving parent. I'm going to allow you to go down the path you've chosen. I'm going to still be there with you. I'm not going to leave you. And I'm going to keep saying to you, are you sure this is the path you want? Are you feeling anything from that? Then he raises up judges and delivers. And this deliver, and the word is a different deliver, this deliver actually means to open space. So the judge is raised up to open space, to give experience of his presence. Here I am as your father, as your deliverer. I'm still with you. I'm still giving you a place to flourish. Because the Lord stays in his own rhythm. His rest, so he worked. He worked his CPR, right? He went in there. He had to give a lot of breath. There was an emergency. And then he pulls back and he rests. And as you pull back from the person you've just given a lot more oxygen to, you pull back. And what God does is he pulls back and he rests. And in the rest, he sees the whole picture. He doesn't just see the emergency now. Now he sees the whole picture and he says, wow, but you're only dust. And you're broken. And you're not able to fix yourself. And I have compassion for you. So it's not that God is angry here and compassionate here. It's part of his rhythm. I am so concerned about you not breathing. And now that I've given you a little breath, I'm going to sit back and go, oh, he can't fix himself. The breath had to come from me. And I feel so compassionate for him. This is God's rhythm. He's going to force himself to breathe harder. And then he's going to sit back and say, I have such compassion for you. I'm going to lift you up. Because you're just dust. And you're broken and you're unable to fix yourself. Israel's response to the resuscitation, not great, right?
No.
They're almost like, oh, okay, you gave me enough breath. I woke up and now, right? Don't you see that a lot? Somebody who has oxygen mask on them, they're like, get that away from me. And they turn their head to the side. This is exactly what Israel does. Okay, you woke me up, great. And I'm going to go right back to what I was doing. The funny thing is, we actually lift up people as heroes who do this. There's lots of movies. The last movie I can remember is, and I don't remember the name of it, it's the NASCAR movie where the two drivers, true story.
Oh, yeah.
The two drivers are, you know, daredevils. And, you know, they're race car drivers. And, you know, they crash. And, you know, they're laying in the hospital bed watching the next race. And what do you think they do? They get up from the hospital bed and they decide they're going to go race. They've just escaped from a near-death experience because of the way that they're driving. And they're like, I am going to conquer this. I'm going to do this, right? I'm going to take off the helps that I need. And I'm going to get back there because I'm going to conquer it. And we look at them as heroes. And God says, no, don't take the oxygen mask off. Didn't you notice that you could actually breathe now with my breath in you? Don't you want more of that? And Israel says, no. And so they turn their head over. And it says, they did not abandon their practices. Notice practices, their rhythm. Or their stubborn ways. They kept on. They went back to following the gods. And the word actually means they did it to themselves. They corrupted themselves there. The truth is that God keeps his commitment to us. We do not. Not just Israel, but us. We don't keep our commitment. No matter what you have told God, you don't keep that commitment. Mm-hmm. Our only hope for life is depending on his commitment to us. It's God's commitment to us is what we cannot refuse. So if he's needing to give us more breath, if he says we're in an emergency, we're in an emergency. And we need to let him give us the breath. Even though to us it looks like his anger is burning. Even though to us it looks like, I mean, how many stories have you heard of paramedics giving someone breath and they break their ribs? You hear that? That hears that all, that happens all the time. And for that person who was unresponsive and the paramedic broke their ribs, does that person wake up and go, oh, I can't believe you did that. You broke my ribs. And that happens. That's what Israel's doing, and that's what God is saying. Really? I broke your ribs to save you. I broke your ribs so that you can have a life that you were meant to have, that's flourishing, that's whole. So are we willing to say, it's not my striving to do what God says to do. It is my commitment to allow him to lead me, Allow him, when an emergency happens, to breathe into me forcefully, whatever that is. And to see, to start looking, what's God doing? Where is God? God is always keeping covenant, making a place for us to image bear. So what God says at the end of Judges 2 is that you're going to continue on this way? All right, I'm going to let you, and I'm going to use that as an invitation back. I'm going to let you go on that thorny path, and you're going to get all these burrs. I'm not going to take the burrs off of you. I'm going to use those burrs so that eventually you're tired of carrying those burrs. Eventually they become too prickly and too many, and you say, oh, this burden is heavy. I want to get rid of it. So I will use what you choose in order to bring you back to the place that's open for you to be an image bearer that flourishes. So, Father, thank you that you are a God who desperately wants us to possess it all. Lord, I pray that today and this week that we will desire to be Aksa, that we will desire to take what our bridegroom has fought for, what you have given us as a gift. May we possess it. May we desire to go after it. May we allow you in those times of emergency to breathe into us your breath. May we see it with your eyes that it is for our life. And may we be amazingly in awe that you follow us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Go forth into the world in peace, rejoicing in the power of the Spirit.
Thanks be to God. Next week, go ahead and do lesson 2, and just begin to start filling out your map for 11 through 21. I will give you time next week to do some of that, but you may need to start on it this week.
Okay, so when we were talking about the story.